Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. I'm Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, what is corruption? Well, that really depends on who's answering and what their interests are. But first, here's a quick Tax Justice roundup for this month. British Prime Minister David Cameron's anti-corruption summit is over. It was a bit thin on the ground. Representatives from 40 countries turned up and only 11 of them were heads of state or actually in government. So the outcomes? Well, 12 countries are now supporting country-by-country reporting for multinational companies on their tax affairs. There was no commitment from Tax Haven USA to anything. Bearing in mind the UK's satellite havens account for a quarter to a third of all the global offshore action, the absolute minimum for David Cameron to be able to claim genuine progress would have been for him to oblige them to join the UK in implementing a public register of the beneficial owners of offshore companies. So, did they do it? No, they didn't. But Afghanistan, Kenya, Nigeria, South Africa, the Netherlands and France did. France was the real trailblazer, being the only country to commit to a public register that also includes trusts and foundations. Good for them. Those who buy property in Britain through offshore shell companies or already own property will now have to declare the real owners in this public register, as will those bidding on government contracts. That particular one's really good news. But, back to the real owners of property. Law firms must surely be booking lots of billable hours with their clients inquiring about maintaining their anonymity by moving from offshore companies to trusts. What else? Oh, we've now got a grandly titled International Anti-Corruption Coordination Centre, and we're going to have a Global Asset Recovery Forum next year, and a few pledges on various things, mainly to be good boys and girls. Those are the Corruption Summit news headlines. Now we're going to talk to the Tax Justice Network's Nick Shackson for his take on this month. OK, Nick, so we've had the anti-corruption summit this month in the City of London, the capital of sleaze, so an appropriate place to talk about corruption. Can you give us a mark out of 10 in terms of progress at the summit?
Well, a mark out of 10, a mark for what we expected, maybe, I don't know, 5, kind of more or less in the middle of expectations. A mark out of 10 for what they could have done, I'd give it maybe a 3. Well, I think the best thing that came out of the summit was it really showed that there's been a sea change in thinking about corruption, in public understanding that's been going on, the world's media, the NGOs, and policymakers as well. You know, this is the sort of stuff that's getting, in Britain anyway, is getting discussed in pubs and restaurants, and, you know, you stand in queues and you hear people chatting about tax dodgers. There's been a real profound cultural shift. That's why the current government has been forced into at least the appearance of action and to a certain degree some action on this issue, whereas before there was just no reason to do anything, no political reason to do anything. There just wasn't the pressure. Back in 2006, the Tax Justice Network first started making a new analysis, putting a new analysis together, saying we need to bring tax havens into the corruption debate. Until then, nobody was putting two and two together. Nobody was really talking about corruption and tax havens. It started really with John Christensen. He did a presentation at the Royal Geographical Society in September 2006, and then he put together a document called Mirror, Mirror on the Wall, Who's the Most Corrupt of All? Making the point that traditional understandings of corruption had been pointing the finger, particularly at African countries, saying you're all corrupt. With the kind of smug implication, you know, we're all pretty clean. And you'd have things like Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, which would have, you know, all the African countries and, you know, developing countries at the bottom, at the top, squeaky clean places like Switzerland, Luxembourg, United Kingdom, United States, sort of the cleanest countries. And with our kind of knowledge of tax havens, not only how dangerous and how important they are, but also where they are. You know, I was just beginning to look at this stuff back in 2006, 10 years ago, and there was no understanding out there of where the tax havens were. It was all sort of the traditional images of sunny islands, Cayman Islands, and and you know, Switzerland maybe, but no mention of the United States, the United Kingdom as central players in the whole system of offshore secrecy. You know, that Corruption Perceptions Index certainly didn't consider tax havens at all, in the sense that, you know, huge amounts of the proceeds of corruption, of embezzlement, of bribery being sucked out of Africa and other developing countries into tax havens. Surely they're part of the corruption picture. So what we saw with the Anti-Corruption Summit, there was a huge investigation by the Financial Times, lots of opinion articles in the newspapers, all making the connection, saying Britain is a central player in the system of tax havens, and here's an anti-corruption summit, and tax havens have got a lot to do with corruption. There was also a certain amount of commentary about the United States as well. Secretary of State John Kerry was at the summit, and he was accused by the Isle of Man and other tax havens of being a giant tax haven, and they were right to accuse the United States of that. The US is a great big center and repository for the world's dirty money. There was also recognition by policymakers that tax havens are part of the problem. And it was refreshing that a Nigerian president could come to London, Muhammadu Buhari, and give a speech in which he criticizes Western countries for corruption and for fostering and encouraging corruption. He was saying, you know, of course, we have corruption in our own countries to deal with, but you guys, you are partners in corruption.
Right, and the much talked about blacklists of the past and in any future blacklists are so unlikely to include a player like the United States, which is one of the problems.
The reason that countries like the US have not typically been put on blacklists in a tax haven concept is simply because they're powerful, and you know, the bodies that put these together have, you know, the US as their biggest and most powerful member, so it, you know, doesn't allow this stuff to happen, which is one reason why it's important to have blacklists that are based on objectively verifiable criteria, such as the Financial Secrecy Index. It has open and transparent criteria for financial secrecy, and it will identify jurisdictions without fear or favour. And I think that's what you need. You need to move away from politicised blacklists from bodies like the OECD and the IMF, which are too frightened to call out big, powerful countries.
Right, so, and what was actually delivered in concrete terms?
There were some benefits, some positive changes, but not the deep radical change we were looking for. Essentially, we were looking for, particularly the UK and the US, the UK to announce a kind of radical sea change to force its tax havens, the Cayman Islands, the British Virgin Islands, Gibraltar, Jersey, Guernsey, all of these places, to force them into a new radical era of transparency. That didn't happen. We want to see public registers of beneficial ownership for companies and also trusts. We want to see a new era of transparency on trusts, which are kind of a bit like companies in terms of secret ownership of stuff, but more slippery and devious and technically more difficult to grapple with. But the approach so far has been to say, well, trusts are too difficult, there's nothing we can do about it, let's park this for the future. I think the time has come to really start doing something about trusts. From the part of the United States, John Kerry sort of re-announced some steps that have been taken, but not nearly enough. The United States is still wide open as a dirty money haven, and it's very easy to put your money in there in secret. And the US is not cooperating effectively with other countries to share information. It's just hoovering up all sorts of criminal money and dirty money and abusive money from around the world. And, you know, there have been some nice fine words and some fine sounding initiatives from the US recently, but nothing that isn't sort of so riddled with loopholes that it isn't going to make much difference.
In terms of the public register that we were calling for with beneficial owners of companies, trusts, and foundations, the French did actually commit to that. So when the political will is there, the action does follow. And they have been the first, I think, in the world to commit to that.
Well, you know, it is all a question of political will.
And in terms of Britain's role being one of the biggest global players in financial secrecy, they could actually have obliged their satellite havens to commit to public registers, which at the moment they're talking about central registers, which is far from what is really needed. Tell us how they could have forced them, because they would deny that that's the case, and the British government would deny that's the case. And why would they not force them if they could?
In Britain, you know, the tax haven system, the system of offshore tax havens, particularly the overseas territories and crown dependencies, are so embedded in the British establishment in the City of London that this is a relic of the British Empire, which, you know, these are the kind of last vestiges of the British Empire, which didn't become independent, and they became kind of satellite tax havens feeding the City of London. You know, the interests are so big, so much greater than, you know, say in France that you mentioned. On the one hand, they use this kind of distance, you know, they have their own independent, often rather corrupt politics. And on the other hand, you have Britain supporting them. You know, they have the Queen's head on their money and on their stamps, and the final Court of Appeal is in London. And, you know, the guarantee, the British courts system, which they use, is a real kind of bedrock that brings an awful lot of money in. Not always for nefarious purposes. So on the one hand, Britain kind of supports these places. On the other hand, there is this kind of distance, and it's very convenient. So the support and connection really helps bring the money in, because people don't want to send it off to, you know, Vanuatu or somewhere they don't know and don't trust. So they're very happy to bring it into a sort of trusted British court system. But at the end of the day, you know, I mean, the ultimate thing Britain can do, as it did with the Turks and Caicos Islands and other overseas territories, I think it was in 2009, just stepped in and imposed direct rule. But they can do a lot of things directly on a much more piecemeal basis. You know, the legislation that these places create gets sent up to London for approval, and they can strike down this legislation. There are various things they can do. And it is a question of political will. Cameron and the British government don't seem to have shown the political will to actually do this, and instead they're taking this much more softly, softly, come on chaps, let's do the right thing here kind of approach, which is, you know, from our point of view, is just simply not good enough.
Yeah, and we're actually in this situation now where Afghanistan, Kenya and Nigeria have committed to public registers of companies. But in fact, Britain's own overseas territories and crown dependencies haven't.
Well, isn't that a fine irony? Indeed, yes. The idea of public registers of beneficial ownership of companies was kind of viewed as a crazy, outlandish idea that just a few people like TJN were putting forwards, even very recently. And I think that is no longer seen as an outlandish idea. And I think that is going to come in the next few years. So the summit should be seen as just one stage in that direction. I don't see much way back. And I think we are going to see a lot more progress. You know, so you basically got two opposing forces. You've got heat from the streets pushing in one direction, voters pushing, you know, for positive reforms. And in the other direction, all these vested interests reluctant to reform.
Thanks, Nick. Nick Shackson of the Tax Justice Network and author of the book Treasure Islands, Tax Havens and the Men Who Stole the World. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Throughout the Anti-Corruption Summit in London this month, the same question came up and was discussed time and time again on the media. What is corruption? The answer seems simple enough, until you realise the answer is political. This month, the TaxCast explores how politicians and the global finance industry want us to look in the wrong direction. In this clip coming up, you can just about hear the British Prime Minister David Cameron describing Nigeria and Afghanistan to the Queen as fantastically corrupt, just as they were on their way to his anti-corruption summit in the City of London, one of the world's most significant hubs for dirty cash.
We've had a very successful cabinet meeting this morning. We were talking about our anti-corruption summit. We've got the Nigerians. We've got some leaders of some fantastically corrupt countries coming to Britain. Nigeria and Afghanistan, possibly the two most corrupt countries in the world.
This was how Nigeria's President Buhari responded.
I'm not going to demand any apology from anybody. What I'm demanding is the return of assets. What would I do with apology? I did something tangible.
You could be forgiven for wondering whether the sun ever set on the colonial era as the nation of cricket lovers and supposed fair play benevolently shows these fantastically corrupt nations the light. A lot of the media focus swung away from the global architecture of corruption, with tax havens and the world's wealthiest nations at its core, and instead towards discussions about bribery, stolen public money and low-level corruption. Here's Will McMahon of the Centre for Crime and Justice Studies in the UK.
Quite how we can have a British government holding an anti-corruption summit because we are clean and others aren't, I don't know. It's remarkable. I think, personally, it goes back a very long way. You might as well go back to the East India Company. The relationships between the British Empire and corporations is they're twins, really, and they have impacted on each other and supported each other for several hundred years. So it really shouldn't come as a surprise that they are still embedded in the heart of the City of London. And this is why I think government and others in the city don't really want to talk about this issue, because it goes back to Britain's role in the world and how it built relationships through finances and through the management of large amounts of money in offshore accounts. And so it's a big issue for this country. It's a very big issue.
For many, the so-called Panama Papers scandal was firmly located in corrupt Central America, but it might just as well have been called the British Virgin Islands Papers, because over half of the offshore companies registered by the law firm Mossack Fonseca were in the British overseas territory, the British Virgin Islands, a very opaque tax haven that's refusing to accept any meaningful financial transparency measures. Those with interests in perpetuating the idea that corruption happens elsewhere are always trying to persuade us to look in the wrong direction. Here's Professor Vincenzo Ruggiero of the Crime and Conflict Research Centre at Middlesex University. If you really want to tackle corruption, he says, tackle the structures facilitating corruption. Take the mafia, for example.
If the mafia has gone on and on and on for decades, a century, it's because, obviously, the allies that they have within the political world and the economic world are such that they can reproduce themselves. I mean, my question is, who corrupts whom? See? So is it true that the mafia, by entering the economy, corrupts the economy? Or is it true that the mafia enters an economy which is already corrupt? When a few years ago there was public alarm, if you like, that the mafia was entering the City of London. And so a conference was organised and I was invited to speak at this conference. And my paper was very provocative, if you like, say, well, if there is a case that the mafia is entering the City of London, I think the problem is the City of London, it's not the mafia. The mafia goes wherever there is a possibility. You know, the scandalous thing that we still have in Britain, in my view, is there are still places where you can open up a trust in Guernsey, in some Channel Islands, for £1. You know, there are people there whose job in those islands is to act as a face, what do you call it?
Front.
Exactly.
You're talking about things like nominee directors.
And prestanomi, we call them.
It's a typical name thing, lenders.
But, yeah, exactly, name lenders, which is a typical mafioso thing. Well, how did we allow this?
Good question. Time and time again, people like David Cameron talk of corruption as a global south problem, something that happens over there. His finger pointing at the so-called fantastically corrupt Nigeria and Afghanistan is helped no end by his claim that Britain's the 10th least corrupt country in the world, according to Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index. But that index doesn't really help us very much because it focuses on extortive corruption, the despots and dictators stealing money from their people, bribes paid on the street to keep the police at bay or to jump a bureaucratic queue. That kind of corruption does have a devastating effect on people's lives, there's no doubt about it. But if you look at the other end of the kaleidoscope at the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index, you'll find that actually the UK, combined with its crown dependencies and overseas territories, is actually ranked the world's number one player in global financial secrecy. Other nations among the top 10 include the world's richest and most powerful nations like the United States and Switzerland. Fantastically corrupt, you might say. Now, if David Cameron and governments of the global north really want to tackle corruption, they'd focus on the respectable pinstriped suits and shiny offices of the law firms, accountancy firms, bankers and company formation agents, the enabler professions and tax haven secrecy that's at the heart of global corruption. But the defences politicians have helped build around them are nothing short of branding genius. It's collusive corruption that's protecting the financial structures that make fraud, money laundering and tax dodging possible. It's the increased blurring between public and private interests over the last few decades where the biggest dangers lie. Will McMahon.
I think when the government tries to marketize almost everything that we have in society, they change the way that the services are delivered to suit the private sector. And you can see this across a whole range of institutions and a whole range of privatizations that have been going on. Is everything as it should be? And I think most people, in a very common sense way, would say, no, it isn't. We wanted to know what the public thought about a number of very common practices that take place between government and business. And we had our own views about them. They concerned us, but we wanted to know whether the public, if they had them described to them in very neutral terms, whether they would think they're a good thing or a bad thing. So we decided to put together a series of questions about the relationship between government and industry to see what the public made of it.
Until now, no one's ever actually asked the British public what they think of as corruption of the public interest and practices that have become a normal way of doing business and politics in Britain. Will McMahon joined forces with Professor David White of the University of Liverpool and the Tax Justice Network to ask people about the acceptability of a series of examples based on real-life relationships between the public and the private sector in the UK. Here's Professor David White, editor of the book, How Corrupt is Britain?
We have a really serious problem about sorting out what the public interest is from private interest, from business interest, and a real serious problem about where we draw the line. And it's clear that the public want to draw the line between government and business in terms of that influence and that revolving door. We knew that we were asking questions that hadn't been put to a representative sample of the British people before, and the results are very, very clear. The members of the British public are very, very opposed to some of the practices that we asked them about.
All right, then, let's talk about the poll results. Let's take them one by one. Let's start with the first one. So 73%, which is very high, of the respondents to this poll said that the practice of ministers accepting corporate boardroom appointments on leaving office should be banned. Talk me through that one.
Well, that example was drawn from not just one real example, but one example that happened several times. That when we asked the public that question, we gave them the example of a minister who'd been a health minister who joined subsequently a private health care company. And it's happened something like four or five times in the last 12 years or so, involving ministers from all parties. So we asked them about that real example, and quite clearly they're opposed very strongly to that practice, and you know, it's a regular practice. So we think, given that level of opposition, this has to be taken seriously, and it's very clear how out of step the kind of practices that are scrutinised, for example, by parliamentary committees, but also the rules and regulations of Parliament, are out of step with public opinion.
Okay, let's move on to the next one. So 75%, and this is the highest percentage of all, said that the practice of senior civil servants accepting corporate consultancies should be banned. Interesting.
Yeah, and again, we used a real case scenario as part of that question. We asked, obviously we didn't name any names, but we did give a scenario that had happened in real life, which was the head of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs negotiates a tax settlement with a company to reduce their tax bill, and after leaving that, takes up a new appointment with the accountant that was advising the company. Now, 75% said that kind of arrangement should be prohibited, should be banned.
Right, and another one, very interesting, 62% said inviting private corporations into government to help shape the regulation of business should be banned.
This has become common practice. I mean, there was a time not so long ago, I mean, 20 years ago, where this would raise eyebrows, that a company working in a particular industry would be asked about how that industry should be regulated. It's now commonplace across the board. And we still have overwhelming opposition. We still have 62% 2% saying that this should be banned. We shouldn't have private companies who possibly could benefit from a particular set of regulations being invited to discuss what those regulations should be in government.
Yeah, and we've seen so many examples of this. I mean, just off the top of my head, there's the former head of the British Bankers Association brought in to advise on tax reform. The big four accountancy firms involved in advising government on tax, clear conflicts of interest there. And Google, one of the biggest tax avoiders in the world, involved in high-level panels advising government on business.
Even at the point where we have companies that have been shamed or even prosecuted of offences, we have a government that seems to think it's legitimate to stand up for their interests, and even when these interests conflict with ours, with the public interest.
Right, and next, the public were asked about the Private Finance Initiative, PFI. It's called different things in different parts of the world, but it's a buy now, pay later kind of deal with the public sector. So they end up paying up front for things like hospitals and schools and other public service infrastructure. Then the public pays them back in a sort of mortgage arrangement. But I mean, that doesn't really describe some of the abusive arrangements involved. I mean, the payments are gargantuan. They're at highly preferential rates and terms, often to offshored companies who pay little, if any, tax. And often they just don't seem to be accountable when things go wrong. Public borrowing for these projects would have cost the nation far less. Britain's now struggling with an estimated debt of well over £200 billion to banks and businesses as a result. So 68% say the current private finance initiative arrangements for public projects should be banned.
What happens is, because the public sector is formally not paying for the initial outlay, it doesn't show up on the government's public debt account. So there's a kind of short term and in many ways kind of fake benefit to the public accounts. And very clearly the public are absolutely opposed to these arrangements. If you overcome the objection to paying eight times or five times as much for a building, there are other problems always down the line. 2 weeks ago, it was revealed that PFI built schools in Edinburgh are now crumbling, literally crumbling. They had to move pupils out of those schools. Serious public safety problem for those schools. Children were being put at risk. In Edinburgh, they're scrambling around to find out whether they have to make those repayments, on what basis. And it looks like they have very little comeback and may well have to rebuild the schools and pay for them out of the public purse. The second issue, we know that because of the arrangements which are put together, the partnership agreements that are put together to pay for these deals, the profits are siphoned off in ways that are barely visible. So we know a large amount of the PFI profits go into tax havens, flow straight out of the country into tax havens. So we have a problem of transparency that's intimately bound up with the way that those PFI deals are financed and then the way that the profits flow out of those deals.
Will McMahon.
Nothing illegal is happening here. You know, the PFI is not legal. The relationship between the government and tax companies is not legal. But actually, they are colluding together through the use of law and advice for the benefit of very powerful people. Now, this collusion, I think, needs to be brought out into the open. And I think once the public know about it, as I think this survey shows, they're not happy with it and they want to do something about it. And this is hopefully going to build on the criticism that the public have had about many corporations avoiding taxes. It's another aspect of that. And these corporations got away with that because the government colluded with them. Nobody can tell us that the government didn't know that X corporation was paying very little tax. They did, but they were in each other's pockets. And that this poll shows the public don't like it is incredibly encouraging. This again is a question of accountability, right? It is really important that companies who are in charge of large amounts of finances are not allowed simply to hold money that's been flowing around the world economy from illegal practices and from heists, basically. I mean, what happens in some countries is you get privatisation processes where individuals enrich themselves from this. They stick the money in the City of London and salt it away, so it's in a safe place. None of this is particularly transparent. It should be held to account. And Parliament in particular, and politicians in particular, have a key role in making sure that this accountability happens. Now, the problem is, if that's their key role, and yet some of them are being offered jobs in the companies that are helping this salting of money away to happen, then there's a massive conflict of interest. That clearly shouldn't happen.
You can read all about these survey results in the latest Tax Justice Focus, the corruption issue. You'll find that under reports on the Tax Justice Network website, www.taxjustice.net. You've been listening to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.